Welcome, everyone, to News of the Money World. I'm Darcy Ungaro. Rupert Carline, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you, Darcy?
Very good. Very good. Let's get started today because there's so much to get into. Let's quickly cover off the Ether ETF. So Ethereum, just for a little bit of background, is a cryptocurrency. We don't probably need to go that basic, do we? But it's a cryptocurrency, and much like we had the SEC, a Bitcoin spot ETF, right now, the SEC, well, not right now, a couple of weeks ago, the SEC approved an Ether ETF. So there's still a few, as I understand, there's still a few regulatory processes that have to go through, but those feel like they're probably just more things of formality more than anything serious. I'm curious, like I've got a few opinions on this, Rupert, but because with Kura KiwiSaver, you guys do a carbon neutral cryptocurrency fund, before I get on my opinion on this, what do you think you guys are going to do around this? Are you going to be quite keen to adopt Ethereum into your portfolio in your crypto specialist fund?
Well, I think for us, it's kind of interesting, right? We've talked to quite a few of our members and some people in the crypto community over the last couple of weeks. And the resounding feedback from most of them is they don't want us to. They see Bitcoin as being something a whole lot safer, a whole lot kind of different to all of the other crypto assets, including Ethereum, which did surprise me. So, yeah, the feedback from a lot of people has been, hey, at this stage, we see Bitcoin kind of out on its own, a store of value, kind of the bellwether of the crypto industry. And actually, we think it's got a very different risk profile to everything else. And therefore, we think that you're better off sticking purely in Bitcoin. And yeah, it's pretty hard to argue with that argument. So I think from my perspective, we'll probably stay out of it at this stage.
Interesting. Yeah, well, can I say that I'm proud of you, Rupert?
I wasn't expecting that.
You know, like I just think that, so that view that you're obviously picking out from people would probably be a really similar held view that I would personally hold, where I just feel like as an asset, just thinking about Bitcoin and Ethereum, Bitcoin is clearly, its use case is store of value currently.
Yep.
And therefore an exchange traded fund or a mainstream traditional finance wrapper around a store of value asset, which really is meant to be acquired and held. And that's what I do like about the ETF or owning it through funds, is that it solves the self-custody problem that some people have. And yeah, it doesn't give you the ability to transact with that crypto asset as a medium of exchange, as a form of money, but it is good if your primary interest is number go up and increasing overall returns in your KiwiSaver portfolio without increasing volatility. But with Ethereum, that's an asset which is completely different. In my mind, that's a crypto asset that's meant to be used. It's like, that's the asset that you build stuff on that maybe decentralized finance and financial systems of tomorrow might be run on networks similar to Ethereum, not just Ethereum. I think there's other networks like Solana in particular that are quite interesting in terms of this base layer technology that could be quite useful, but it doesn't feel like the type of asset that you would want to lock up and wrap up in an exchange traded fund, unless there was the ability to unlock yield. And from what I understand, even though Ethereum can be staked, and so it's kind of almost like a bond sort of type asset where you get revenue, my understanding, correct me if you know any different at this stage, my understanding is that these ETFs probably won't have yield built into them. They'll just be holding the actual asset itself.
Yeah, because I think from a custody perspective, it's pretty hard to do the staking. You've got to put your trust in a whole lot of other things and a whole lot of other people. The likes of the big guys, the big traditional finance houses, they don't want to trust anyone. So, and I actually have quite a bit of respect for that view as well, right? That their view is they're there for the capital appreciation and they want to minimize the risk where they can. The challenge I'd give you back to your analogy though, Darcy, is I do believe, I mean, a lot of people are still, you're buying Ether because you believe that the Ethereum network will continue to get more and more use cases and more traffic. And so, the Ethereum network has a whole lot more and is a whole lot more valuable, but at the same time, has a whole lot more uses, sorry. But at the same time, Ether is kind of the value perspective on that in my mind as well. So I do think you will get a lot of people buying it and holding it for long-term value. I think It's really going to be the difference is, though, Bitcoin's got that first mover advantage. And as you say, Solana and a whole lot of others will come yapping in behind it. Probably what that means is actually it's better suited to having four or five other assets put in with it, right? So a fund that's got a combination of Ethereum, Solana, Avalanche, that's something that looks really interesting because all of a sudden you've got that whole distributed ledger as its own separate fund.
Yeah. We'll see, right? Like, I think so far, though, the hype isn't there like it was with the Bitcoin fund. And I think this speaks to a broader reality that we're skirting around, which is that regardless of what you and I might think of this sector, most people have no idea what the difference is between Bitcoin and Ethereum. And to them, it's all crypto and it's all the same. And like the feedback that you had from other people who are into crypto already, there is a very distinct view that there's Bitcoin and then there's crypto. It's of, but it is not representative of, it's not the same thing as. So I think that that's where the industry, the regulators, they probably don't appreciate that difference either, if I was to guess, because I was really surprised that this Ether ETF was approved by the SEC. And it's good, don't get me wrong, because it's kind of like, it's just another endorsement during a season where we're seeing Trump being incredibly pro-crypto. We're seeing Elizabeth Warren kind of put back into her place, potentially. We're seeing some of this anti-crypto rhetoric soften just a little bit, which I find that really fascinating from a, I guess, from a more of a macro perspective as to what the US is trying to do now. But I think that if it gives people in the crypto industry optimism, it's because it's more like traditional finance is putting the stamp of approval on something, which means that, hey, there's less risk now than there once was before from a regulatory uncertainty perspective. So therefore, there's going to be more investment. And really, that's the exciting part, because some of the stuff that they're building on Ethereum and Solana in particular is phenomenal. Like, what can actually be done? NFTs, we've all forgotten about that. But there's stuff that's still being built on that. And even just the ability to have alternative, like digital asset exchanges that could one day potentially replace traditional finance rails for managed funds even is going to be really, really interesting to watch that. But that's probably all possible now because of this stamp of approval that these ETFs are bringing. So overall, it's good.
So just finally on that though, the stamp of approval I find really interesting because yes, it was awesome that stamp of approval has been given, but the honest truth is there are so many wacky, weird, hyper-risky ETFs in the market. This isn't, my view is this isn't any riskier, right? I mean, you've got like some super esoteric negative return option ETF that does this if gold moves to $1.22. I mean, it's kind of, to my mind, I don't think crypto has been realistically held to the same standard as others here because some of the other products that are in the market, I think, are way riskier than what we currently have here.
Yeah. Well, you're right. It's like, that's why it's so fascinating. I think once you understand this space, when you then reflect on the criticism of it from traditional finance, it's almost like, they're saying, sure, you can have your Ponzi scheme, but it's still not as good as our Ponzi scheme, right? Like, you're clever, check out what we have. So it really is just, I think, a lack of understanding, and it just takes time. These are really simple, open technologies that a lot of people kind of understand faster and easier compared to these triple inverse ETFs that are trading options, right? I certainly wouldn't touch that stuff because it goes beyond my understanding. And even if I did understand it, it's not transparent enough for me to have full faith in it. Yet with most crypto assets, I could at least, if I could be bothered, right? I could at least know where to go to learn more, and I could see stuff to check stuff. And that's I think, the difference that the next wave of investors are going to appreciate. And that's probably really important in this new world where money creation, credit creation has to continue to occur because there has to be more and more interesting things for money to find homes in. Because if there isn't, it ends up in inflation, goods and services go up. Yeah. So markets are kind of like a giant sponge to soak up the excess credit creation that has to occur. It's better than war anyway.
Exactly.
Controversial. Anyway, oh, on the topic of controversial views though, interest rates. You were saying before we hit record that things seem to be flipping here. Yeah. And it's like one week it's, hey, it's going to be lower and sooner. We're expecting rate cuts in September now, maybe not July, but maybe in September. Next week, maybe it's like, hey, it's actually higher for longer. And they both have really compelling narratives. But do you want to kind of break down what you're seeing at the moment and what you think's happening?
Yeah, look, it's been a fascinating kind of 3 or 4 weeks in the interest rate game, right? So we saw, in late May, we saw Canada. They were the first kind of large global economy to go. They reduced rates by 25 basis points, almost in anticipation of the US moving, because it was pretty clear, right? They're still not expecting inflation to drop to below 3% till kind of 2025 at the earliest. But they seem to be far more concerned about the slowing economy and the impact of what happens in the US if the US lowers rates than anything else. We saw the ECB, they went on 30 June, I think it was, or 30 May, sorry, a couple of weeks ago. And so they've already been, and they've dropped their rates too. Again, I find that a really interesting one because it was, they were dropping rates, but we do see the slowdown in inflation slowing, i.e. inflation is higher than we expected. Inflation isn't dropping as fast as we thought, but they've still managed to go ahead with the first 25 basis points of rate cuts. And again, I think, because they're more nervous about this broader slowdown and they're protecting, trying to protect the economy and also trying to protect their export markets for kind of what's going to happen if the US goes first. That's, I think, what was one of the things that impacted those two markets. We had seen a material weakening in the US dollar over the last probably 2 months as we'd kind of started to see take this view that actually the US was getting ready to go long on rates. Mm. Well, sorry, go short on rates and bring rates down. And then the final piece of the puzzle, which kind of fascinating as we round out the G7, was last week. So I think, again, we'd had 2 or 3 weeks of pretty weak economic data out of the US. And all of a sudden, a July rate cut was on the table. So kind of potentially 6 weeks away when we kind of get to a point of reducing rates. However, on Friday last week, we got an absolutely blockbuster jobs report. 274,000 new jobs created versus an expectation of about 160. And probably more concerning, we had wage growth of 0.4% over that prior month versus an expectation of 0.3%. So it means that the labor market is actually significantly tighter than they had anticipated. And until, I think we've talked about before, until we see that labor market start to come off, then it's going to be really, really hard to kind of to see inflation coming all the way back down. The reaction to this news was actually really interesting because on one hand, it shows the US economy is stronger than expected. What it also does is it clearly means that it's clearly going to push those interest rate hikes out. And the commentary that I found the most fascinating about it all was there were 3 or 4 economists coming out going, fuck, actually, is the Fed policy, is it actually not restrictive enough? And we started to see people go, hold on a sec, do we need to bring back on the table this idea of further rate hikes? And I suspect if we get another upside surprise data print, that's where the conversation's likely to head to. So it is kind of really interesting on where we are, right? So Citi put out a really good note, July, now September, with 2 rate cuts. All of a sudden, what happened to 3 months ago, we were saying no one was going to be allowed to cut rates just leading into the US election. So huge amount going on, but kind of definitely a flip of those narratives, and we're now back into hold on a sec, strong growth, high for longer, all of that kind of good stuff that we were talking about 4 or 5 weeks ago.
Yeah, it's just a fascinating time to be alive, especially in an election year, like with the US. I guess if rate drops happen between now and the election, that's favoring Biden. If it stays high, kind of favors Trump because he's got that ability to pull that lever, maybe. I don't know. But there is this really, I don't even know if this is a theory because I made it up. So it could just be like a really wacky dream that I had. I had some peanut butter on toast before I went to bed. Don't recommend that, but it does give you some really bizarre dreams every now and then. I don't know if you've noticed that, but so here's the thing. If we have the US, the Federal Reserve, right, and effectively they're controlling the value of the dollar sort of by changing the Fed funds rate, the higher that rate is relative to the other countries, it's like a moth to light, sucks all the value there. And we've had Canada, we've had the ECB drop, and they drop over in Europe, in New Zealand, Australia, other countries as well. Potentially they might follow suit before the US. If there's a higher for longer regime, it'll probably be in the US. And what would happen if all the other countries went first? That would be interesting, right? Because that would, I guess, increase export earnings for all those other countries. So there's kind of like an incentive to allow that to happen, if I'm reading that correctly. It increases the value of the dollar, which increases the force applied via the International Monetary Fund. So the IMF is a conduit where the G10 countries, so the US is one of them, of course, they all collude or they cooperate in the interest of the International Monetary Fund. And they're effectively giving out US dollar denominated loans to developing countries. So what better way to get the developing world on your side than to make them dependent on those loans and make it more expensive to service those loans, which cranks up the value of the dollar. It reeks to me of financial warfare. And my dark theory here is that what has been happening and what continues to happen with central bank alignment says a lot more about this globalized effort in financial warfare than it does about these individual countries. So I haven't got my tinfoil hat on today, but what do you think of that crazy theory?
I think that it's not a concerted effort. It would be now my personal view, but it does have the implications, right? There's no question one of the reasons why the ECB went and went early, and one of the reasons why Canada went and went early, is because they did not want a stronger euro or stronger Canadian dollar. They wanted to protect their export markets. And so I do firmly believe that interest rates are being used by some of these larger economies to control their currencies. And that kind of does seem to be one of the biggest concerns that they have, right? You think about, the German car industry really, really struggling at the moment with imports from China, the US, other parts of the world. And this is going to be really, really important to them. Canada, a large mineral exporter. And so you go, actually, a weak Canadian dollar is a massive friend for them as well. So was it a concerted effort to control? I'm not sure on that one, but it definitely people are using interest rates at the moment to kind of try and control the outputs. I think increasingly what I have seen, the IMF stuff, it is denominated in US dollars, but at the same time, a lot of it is hedged and protected back into local currencies, which is why over the last couple of years, as we've seen the US dollar strengthen, we haven't seen that slew of defaults and the carnage in emerging markets that we normally would. So you go back kind of 5-10 years, and actually whenever we had strong or high US interest rates, strong US dollar, you kind of, there'd be absolute chaos everywhere because all of these foreign markets had debt denominated in US dollar. So I think, I don't know, I firmly do agree that the US Treasury has weaponized the US dollar. And kind of with the use of it, with how they've kind of using sanctions and also kind of almost threatening companies and banks in particular and going, you can't do that piece of business, otherwise we're going to cut you out of the dollar. There is some interesting stuff going on there, though. There's no question on that.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm not super crazy, but probably just half crazy.
The balance between conspiracy and reality, as always, it sits in the middle. And I think there is a middle here.
Yeah, that's right. We'll call it coincidence theory, right? But even just simple things like there's Russian ships, oil tankers pulling up next to Chinese oil tankers to transfer oil on the sea to sort of circumvent all these sanctions. Like, there's a lot of maneuvering going on to like one up the competition, right? And if you're going to put that on me, then we're going to do this to get around it. We're going to form our own currency block to get around this. And it's just, we're not in a world where things are fair and people behave themselves, right? Like, these are basically leaders of gangs that are just doing whatever it takes to win sometimes.
It's always been like that, though. And at the end of the day, we all think that's fine because we're aligned with the US and that kind of the Western hegemony, which is kind of the world that we live in, right? I'm sure if it was the other way around, we wouldn't be quite so happy about it.
Exactly. Well, let's keep going on that thread then, because the next thing I wanted to chat with you was this. It seems to be increasing shift politically towards the right, which I don't subscribe to the far left or the far right. It would be good if we didn't have left or right. We just kind of got on with our business, right? But it's a pendulum and it has implications. And what's happening with France right now, President Macron calling a snap election as a maneuver to sort of get, I think, what is it, Le Pen's?
Sorry, Le Pen.
Put her in her box, right? So that there's not a possibility of a center right influence taking root in France. We have Trump in the US. Already in New Zealand, we've had a move to the center right. This sort of thing happens, I guess, in unison. It's quite weird because we've come out of more of a left not that long ago, and now we're shifting this way. But I look at this in terms of the geopolitical implications. It would be awesome if the situation with Russia and Ukraine settled down. It would be great if the Middle East situation settled down. It would be great if China didn't try anything. And I just wonder what the relationship is with the US current administration and the situation in Russia. I'm trying to be careful with how I pitch this. And I wonder how that will change if, say, Trump got in. Same thing with Europe. I wonder what would happen in terms of escalation of war if we move more towards the right. Do you have any views on that one?
No, I mean, it's pretty hard to say, right? For a long time, the right were almost enamored by Putin with his strongman kind of policies and his strongman economics. And also a lot of his ultra-nationalistic tendencies, right? So firm on the historical historical Soviet Union was this, therefore we need to build it back and we're protecting our people. We're kind of drumming the beat on kind of this is Russia as a great country. I do wonder kind of that the Ukraine invasion has almost changed a lot of that and he's gone too far. And he has pushed it a long way. I think so. Kind of one of those historical things that we saw about Russia and the right, I'm not convinced they will come back because I do firmly believe that it's kind of gone too far and become too toxic. However, what's been a really interesting part, and I think one of the key reasons for the rise of the right, the far right, is that actually we've seen over the last kind of 5, 10, 15 years, a massive increase in the disparity between the ultra wealthy and the not. There are a lot of people in the current environment that are missing out. I mean, even you think about New Zealand, right? We've got kind of all of a sudden, huge amount of the conversation is around race-based policies. It's around kind of all of these same conversations, which actually aren't materially different to what we're seeing overseas. And so I guess a really long way of saying, I think increasingly people are going to be focused on themselves. People focus on how do we protect and grow our patch of the woods. So America, a Trump America, is an America that focuses even more heavily on manufacturing. That's a kind of the art of the deal, right? You lose, I win. There is no answer where we can both win. Parts of Europe, I think you're going to start to see the same, right? France, where they're very annoyed because they believe that they're just subsidizing the lazy South, despite the fact that actually the Southern economies are growing way better than the Northern economies. But there's no point in letting truth get in the way of any of these kind of facts. So I think we're going to end up in a world where it becomes increasingly disjointed. Increasingly, the deglobalization trend, which, by the way, is going to be terrible for inflation, and people are going to become much more protective and less happy playing in these kind of large groups. And so really long way of saying, I do firmly, but I do think it means that for the likes of protecting Taiwan, protecting Ukraine, some of those things, do they get harder? Yeah, it probably does, unfortunately, because actually most of the attention is at home. When you've got unhappy people at home, that's what you've got to try and do, right? You fix what your core first, and then you can go out and fix everything else around it. And I think that's probably what the next 5 years of politics looks like, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think people are starting to get a little, and this is probably why we're maybe even subconsciously grasping for center-right politics more because we believe that that's probably better for the economy, and we sense that things are changing and we want to make sure that we're safe and secure financially. There's an increasing angst, maybe in New Zealand, but more so in the rest of the world, that immigration is just not good. Like, this type of immigration is damaging things. Like, you talk to prospective homeowners in Australia, you pick up that vibe pretty quickly. I think the US has an interesting border situation in, well, even in France, like in other parts of Europe, there's an increasing angst picking up. And that'll be interesting to see where that goes. But I guess as we isolate ourselves and we focus on ourselves more, that's not necessarily good for the common good. So we'll see what happens there. We'll see what happens there, eh?
But the big challenge, I think, and this is one of the things been going through my mind for the last kind of couple of weeks, what happens to New Zealand in this new world, right? So if we go, okay, so we've got the US only really focuses on the US, and we kind of have seen that with a lot of the manufacturing, the tariffs, all of that kind of stuff. Europe's always been a bit far away for us, but still, again, they focus on that. Do they become even more protective of those European farmers? China, well, China's China, right? China will take the things they need, but they will do nothing to help anyone else around them. And so little old New Zealand, what does that mean for us, right? Because we don't have a manufacturing industry. We don't have any of these industries that all of these other countries and regions are really pushing. And we're almost at the whim of kind of hoping everyone just still wants to drink our milk and take our logs. And so that's where I find it really interesting, is kind of how does New Zealand fit into this new world? And that's what I can't quite get my head around. I'm not 100% convinced that we do.
So what world are we going to fit into?
Well, we'll always fit into the world, but I don't think we prosper in this new world is probably a better set of words.
Not in our current configuration. Totally agree. It's not like we don't have options, right? We just need to get it out of our way, right? Especially when it comes to, I'll always bring it back to technology, right? Like there's so many more opportunities than we are exploring with technology, in my view. But as we finish up, let's finish up on commercial real estate here in New Zealand, because commercial real estate is fascinating because it isn't just one homogenous thing. We have industrial, retail, office space, and they each kind of dance to their own tune. But I like to think of commercial property as not too dissimilar to bonds, where the price of that asset is inversely correlated to interest rates. So if interest rates go up, value goes down. You can overlay some interesting dynamics there, where in high inflationary times, you're going to see yields go up. So yield just means the revenue divided by the value of that thing. Yields go up partly because, well, rents are indexed to inflation often in these leases. So if CPI is high, rents go up. But if CPI is high, interest rates go up, which means it's more expensive to own these bad boys, and that brings the price down. So that'll change at some stage. It'll stabilize when interest rates drop. But there's other dynamics that happen when you have a struggling economy, right? So would it be fair to say that commercial property kind of leads where bonds would go, or are they kind of, they would they?
Definitely. I mean, and I think, lead might be too strong a word, but probably follow, because the difference between property and bond market is that property is an illiquid market. So it's not as though we're trading the same building each and every single day, right? You are in a fixed interest asset. And I think what we've seen over the last two or three years is we've seen a lot of holding out, where people will only sell if they absolutely have to. Because at the end of the day, 5 years ago, or not five, 3.5 years ago, you were buying buildings at 4.5% yields, and you were doing that because long-term interest rates were at 2.5%. Now we've got long-term interest rates at 4.5%. What does that mean, right? Does that mean yield should now be at 6.5%? Yes. I mean, the math said most definitely. But you haven't seen that. That also implies a 50% fall in the value of a lot of the building stock out there. But we haven't seen that yet. And I think it's kind of, I was talking to someone over the weekend, a big commercial property manager, and he was saying it's finally starting to see it here in New Zealand, that combination of higher interest rates, meaning kind of landlords are struggling to service their buildings, servicing the interest on them. We've got the banks are starting to push through the lower valuations, and so that stuffs up all of the loan-to-value ratios. And then if you own office, then again, you've got some massive occupancy issues. So I think it is a pretty tough time. I think we've done a good job at glossing over a number of the trends that we've seen over the last kind of 12, 24 months. Again, almost similar to some of the economic data and some of that kind of stuff where we were early on with inflation. It was obvious. It kind of had to come. We just didn't want to believe it.
Good point. Good point. So, yeah. But diversification always rules, right? Because you never know in what environment which asset class is going to be pumping and which one's going to be dumping. So sandwich a few together. Little dabble of everything will do you, but don't get too enamored by just one investment. I know a lot of people that are just all in on commercial property. And I love it as well as a concept and own one myself. I think it's cool, but you got to kind of think about what happens when you go through these economic cycles because, like you say, it's illiquid. Different if it's just a portion of your portfolio, but if that is like your primary vehicle, you know, that can be a little bit challenging.
Well, I also think it comes back to time horizon, right? And again, where we go, so we talked about last week, we talked about the residential mortgages, and to me, it all kind of sits in the same bucket, right? Well, actually, we know if you're going to buy properties, leverage them up to the absolute hilt, then we know the moment a little thing goes wrong, then you are highly exposed and it becomes pretty risky. Commercial property like the one that you've got, you've owned it for a long time. You've got manageable, I assume you've got manageable kind of leverage ratios on it. And so it means that you're able to kind of sit there and see through the path. I think for the better part of the last 20, 30 years across most asset classes, people haven't really been hit and had to experience the when things go wrong. And that's what we're starting to see now. And that's definitely what we're starting to see in the commercial property market as well.
Yeah. It's all about them diamond hands, eh? Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. We've covered a ton of stuff. But that
as always,
we can handle. Yeah. And there's still more on my list here anyway. So yeah, plenty of fodder for next week. But next week we're going to see I think we'll have other interest rate adjustments, the US that's happening, I think in a couple of days, our time. So that would have happened. Bit more data would have gone on a little bit closer to seeing some more action in the Ukraine and Russia conflict is my suspicion. So yeah, we'll see what happens. And next week we'll have a few more stories to tell.
Awesome. Okay. Cool. Well, a great chat as always, Darcy.
Awesome. All right. Catch you next time.